This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The Constitution does not give a specific time frame for the Electoral Commission to announce results. It gives the Electoral Commission all the powers it needs to administer election results. However, if the Electoral Commission sees anything untoward that could compromise the credibility of the election, it would have to investigate and then determine its next line of action before deciding when to announce the results.
That's VOA's Peter Cloti reporting from Accra. We'll have the latest on Ghana's presidential and parliamentary elections coming up.
Also, former Tanzanian President Benjamin Mkapa has arrived in Burundi to conduct a dialogue in hopes of ending the current political crisis. And 18 opposition parties in Zimbabwe are trying to unite against President Robert Mugabe in 2018.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, votes counting continues in Ghana as they choose the country's next president and parliament. Incumbent President John Mahama is seeking a second term against main opposition leader Nana Akufo-Addo, the man he defeated 4 years ago. VOA's Peter Cloti is in Accra covering the election. He says reports that Ghana's Electoral Commission is delaying the announcement of initial results are not true, and that the board is simply following standard procedures based on the country's constitution.
The constitution does not give a specific time frame for the Electoral Commission to announce results. It gives the Electoral Commission all the powers it needs to administer election results. However, if the Electoral Commission sees anything untoward that could compromise the credibility of the election, it would have to investigate and then determine its next line of action before deciding when to announce the results. And this morning when I spoke with the spokesperson of the Electoral Commission, Eric Jakwasu, he said there have been instances where there appear to be overvoting. Overvoting means if there are 20 people in the voter list and the 25 people voted, that means it's overvoting. They have to investigate and probably invalidate that polling station. That will take the polling station out of contention and the results will not be added to the national tally. So these are some of the things that they are looking at before coming out to announce certified results for the presidential election.
And these are pretty much normal procedures that they are following.
Yes, they've been doing this since the reintroduction of constitutional rule in Ghana in 1992. That has been the practice.
Also, what are poll observers saying so far about this election?
Well, some of them are very impressed with it. I spoke with Linda Thomas-Greenfield, the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. She went to several polling stations in some parts of Accra, and she was satisfied with the way voters comported themselves during the polls, the efficiency with which poll officials administered the poll in those polling stations. Sometimes there were some logistical challenges where voting started a bit late, but they caught up and added a little bit more time. Now, this morning I spoke with the former Namibian president, Hifikepunye Pohamba, who is leading the African Union poll observer team, and he was particularly impressed, in his words, about how Ghanaians were patient, how the electoral system was transparent, and how he followed the process. The only concern he had was that sometimes the polling booth faced the people who were coming to vote. Although it's a little far away, he was thinking that it should be the opposite way, where people will not see who the voter is voting for. In all, he said he was very impressed with the way the elections were conducted. The domestic election observers, a group that deployed over 8,000 local observers across the country to monitor the polls, and they were also satisfied with the way the elections were conducted. It remains to be seen when the Electoral Commission comes out to announce the outcome of the presidential vote, what their reactions will be.
And I guess this is in spite of there being some accusations of voter intimidation and concerns about the country's Electoral Commission.
Well, that is true. The accusations and counter-accusations of voter intimidation and harassment have come from both the ruling party supporters and main opposition party supporters. This election particularly was one of the most competitive since the reintroduction of constitutional rule. Although most elections have been competitive, this was seen as one of the most competitive among all. So you expect it. But officials of the police that I spoke with on the spot where some of these allegations were made, these were pure misunderstandings, and they were dealt with when the representatives of the parties had meetings with the police to make sure their concerns are addressed.
Has either party at this point made any kind of claims regarding a victory?
Yes, the main opposition party, the New Patriotic Party, have held two press conferences, one at the crack of dawn, the second one a few hours ago. Now, they were basing their announcement on the result, internal polling that they've got. So far, they are leading with the parliamentary seats. They want a significant number, more than half of the 275 parliamentary seats available. In some cases, in the strongholds of the ruling party, the National Democratic Congress. So they said, based on figures they have won the election. However, the NDC folks, the ruling party folks, are saying that it is only the Electoral Commission that has the mandate to declare the presidential vote outcome. And that is what they have been hammering on.
That's VOA's Peter Cloti speaking with me from Accra.
Former Tanzanian President Benjamin Mkapa has arrived in Burundi to lead an inclusive dialogue to end the current political crisis. Some opposition leaders say his visits have become routine but accomplish little. Moses Havyarimana reports from Bujumbura.
Benjamin Mkapa was appointed by five East African countries to facilitate the inter-Burundi dialogue mediated by Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni. Political instability in Burundi erupted early last year after President Pierre Nkurunziza vied for another term in the office. The opposition says it was unconstitutional. The inter-Burundi dialogue has since last year failed to bring an end to the violence in the country. France's ambassador to Burundi, Laurent de la Rose, says that the European Union fully supports the regional mediated dialogue.
We fully support, as the European Union and the member states, and in France in my case in particular, we fully support his efforts. We feel that the only way to solve the current political difficulties in Burundi is by a very aggressive and dynamic approach by the Burundians themselves, and in particular by the Burundians, the Burundian political forces all across the spectrum. We feel that it is essential that parties enter into compromise.
This is not the first time the former Tanzanian president has visited Burundi for consultations with political stakeholders. Opposition leader Agathon Rwasa, who is currently the deputy speaker of the parliament, says that Mkapa's visits are becoming just a routine.
Personally, I think I don't have any impression about this because, after all, it becomes just like a routine. He has been organizing some consultations. I don't really understand why they should be going on consulting instead of just convening a meeting where people should meet and discuss the topics which has been already identified.
The regional inter-Burundi dialogue in July was suspended after the government boycotted the talks. It criticized the presence of some opposition leaders, whom it accuses of plotting the last year's failed coup attempt. Jean-Claude Karegwa is President Pierre Nkurunziza's spokesman. He says the government won't change its approach.
Well, the government of Burundi still holds the same position. We have to comply and abide with United Nations Security Council resolution, which states clearly that only peaceful stakeholders can be convinced to dialogue.
The Burundi dialogue that has been suspended more than seven times since last year, so little hope left for it to be successful. The Burundi government is shifting focus to the national dialogue that is being conducted countrywide under a commission that was set up by President Nkurunziza. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
The 15 minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. On December 1st, five West African countries agreed to stop importing diesel fuel from Europe that has a high sulfur content. It is known as dirty fuel, and its emissions worsen air pollution and contribute to health problems. UN environment officials praise the agreement, but say Africa has a long way to go to meet modern air pollution standards. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Just seven of Africa's 54 countries have already stopped importing the dirty diesel. All are in East Africa, except for Morocco and Mauritius. The West African countries that have agreed to join them are Nigeria, Benin, Togo, Ghana, and Ivory Coast. Their decision does not take effect immediately. Ghana will stop imports in March, and the rest will follow suit next July. Three countries in southern Africa could agree to ban the dirty diesel next year. Jane Akumu focuses on transport issues in Africa for UN Environment.
We've been working on this program for several years now. We started in 2002 with the elimination of lead in petrol, and by 2005, the sub-Saharan Africa region had actually eliminated lead in petrol. So from then, so about 2006, that's when we started the South, especially in the diesel, because of the health benefits and environmental benefits.
Millions of deaths every year are blamed on air pollution. Dirty diesel emissions are linked to asthma, bronchitis, lung cancer, and stroke, as well as heart-related problems. Health officials say children are especially susceptible.
Diesel emissions, especially from the heavy-duty vehicles, the buses, the trucks, are a major contributor to black carbon, which is the second most important climate pollutant.
Black carbon results from the incomplete combustion of fossil fuels. Akumu says while Europe now uses cleaner diesel, some traders there are able to sell dirty diesel to Africa by blending it with other fuels with a lower sulfur content. Traders are taking advantage of the lax fuel standards in many African countries. Much of the dirty fuels exported to Africa come from the Netherlands. Akumu says the low sulfur diesel should not cost consumers more.
I think the next step would also be to look at the kind of vehicles that are coming into these countries. So we've been partnering with countries to introduce cleaner fuels, but the ultimate objective is actually to combine the cleaner fuels and the cleaner vehicles to have vehicle emission standards, which are still lacking in Africa.
Africa imports many older used vehicles. Akumu says, for example, the average age of a car in Ghana is 14 years. UN Environment says a combination of low sulfur fuels with advanced vehicle standards can reduce harmful emissions by vehicles by as much as 90%. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
18 opposition parties in Zimbabwe traveled to South Africa last week to hammer out policies and pick candidates to run against Robert Mugabe in 2018. But the two political stars of the opposition, Morgan Tsvangirai and Joyce Mujuru, decided not to attend. Brian Sims is the Zimbabwe program officer for Washington, D.C.'s Freedom House, a freedom and democracy watchdog. VOA's David Arnold asked him for his views on electoral politics in the Southern African country.
One of the most important things to think about at the moment for opposition parties within Zimbabwe is to find common ground, but also to create a space where mobilization among constituents and other segments of society is available, a space for social movements, for civil society, for trade unions, making sure women and youth are included and they're able to participate. Looking at some of the sort of recent elections that have taken place, particularly in Gambia, where opposition parties have basically joined to find common ground and unite behind a candidate is going to be really, really critical for Zimbabwe. People also really need to be able to trust their political or elected leaders again. One of the big issues in Zimbabwe is that citizens don't trust their leaders. There's a huge trust deficit. One of the ways this can be dealt with is for political leaders to take responsibility for themselves and for the past.
What is there in the past that they are required to take responsibility for?
Things around indigenization, the fast-track land reform program, things like that obviously have very huge implications for the economy at the moment.
What else is there that we need to understand about politics in Zimbabwe and the next election?
One of the big things in Zim, and particularly in Harare, is everything is based on rumor. The primary point that needs to come out of this is just getting people within the opposition parties, particularly Joyce and Tsvangirai's, as they have sort of the most backing in terms of resources, people, and getting them to understand that they have to find a way to come together in order to challenge ZANU-PF within the next election. You've got these 18 parties. If one of them stays out of this coalition, it's going to collapse. So they really need to find a way to put personal ambitions aside, unite behind one common party platform, figure out some sort of leadership structure, whether it's one of them leading and one as a VP, or maybe neither one of them. Maybe they stay party leaders and they decide on another candidate who has some more legitimacy, who doesn't have some of the baggage of, you know, being within ZANU-PF for so long, or doesn't have some of the baggage within the MDC. And then the other primary point is, if Mugabe drops dead tomorrow, is really around whether or not there's someone within ZANU-PF that's able to sort of control the five factions and whether or not they follow their new constitution. The real point really is around getting opposition parties to find that common ground and unite. If they aren't able to do that, you know, we're going to continue to see ZANU-PF in power. We're going to continue to see a weak political opposition, and probably not much will change, and it could get potentially worse.
What you're talking about in terms of coming together is actually these conversations between Joyce Maduro and Morgan Tsvangirai.
But I'm speaking about within the context of the big negotiations that were happening in Cape Town last week with these 18 parties. What ended up happening was Joyce and Morgan were supposed to be there, and they ended up bailing basically the day before, and no one quite knows why. So their party representatives were still there. Other party leaders were still there, but these two decided to not make an appearance. And so the questions around that they're now letting personal ambition get in the way.
You know, these social movements are not political parties, and they seem to have been very careful to separate themselves.
I would also argue there are probably allies within the ruling party, and there are probably allies within government and the civil service. People, they need to be able to engage those three different sort of actors, if you will, in order to actually see change.
All of this supposes that the president will at some point in the near future step down, but has he said anything publicly about that?
Absolutely not. He is slated to be the candidate for the next election. He's not going anywhere.
That was Brian Sims of Freedom House talking to VOA's David Arnold about Zimbabwe's opposition politics.
Republicans in Congress appear divided over President-elect Donald Trump's repeated statements against military intervention on the world stage. VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman reports.
Addressing supporters in North Carolina Tuesday, President-elect Trump pledged to end what he termed a destructive cycle of intervention and chaos and said the United States, quote, will stop racing to topple foreign regimes that we know nothing about, that we shouldn't be involved with.
You're going to be involved where you want to be or not.
Republican Senator Lindsey Graham provided what he described as his two cents of advice for Trump.
You can't defeat radical Islam from our shores. You have to be on the ground over there. And you can't maintain victory without a follow-on presence.
Trump also formally announced he has chosen retired Marine General James Mattis as his nominee for Secretary of Defense. Mattis is no stranger to U.S. military interventions. He commanded a Marine division during the 2003 invasion of Iraq and later oversaw U.S. operations in Afghanistan and Iraq as head of U.S. Central Command. Trump's choice of Mattis was applauded by Republican John McCain, chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee and a tireless advocate of a more assertive U.S. role on the world stage.
Obviously, he knows what he's getting with General Mattis, but General Mattis, obviously, he and I share the same view about the importance of American leadership.
Some Republicans, like Senator Richard Shelby, have warmed to the president-elect's statements on U.S. military might.
We can't govern the world. We don't want to govern the world. We don't want to be the world's policeman.
Non-interventionism is more commonly advocated by left-of-center Democrats than right-leaning Republicans. But Democrats like Senator Chris Murphy, who agree, at least conceptually, with Trump's anti-regime change message, say they do not trust the messenger.
When George Bush was running for his election in 2000, he told us that he wasn't going to be toppling any regimes either. And then he put a bunch of people in the State Department and the Defense Department who were committed to toppling regimes.
While advocating a judicious use of American military power, Trump nevertheless pledged to defeat Islamic State and other terrorist groups. Michael Bowman, VOA News, The Capitol.
Italy is gearing up for possible new elections following the resignation of Prime Minister Matteo Renzi. He is stepping down after the no vote in a referendum on constitutional change. Economic and political issues drove voters to punish Renzi, but analysts say Italy's migrant crisis also played a role. It's likely to be taken to be a key feature in forthcoming election campaigns. Henry Ridgewell reports for VOA.
More than 176,000 migrants are being housed in reception centres spread across Italy. And prior to his loss in a referendum Sunday, outgoing Prime Minister Matteo Renzi threatened to veto the EU budget in a bid to force Europe to share Italy's burden.
Diventa leader in Europa perché la situazione internazionale è un tale caos.
Renzi said the international scene is in chaos and Europe is struggling, adding the countries most recently brought into the European bloc are those that dream of building walls. The appeal was too little, too late, says Eurasia Group analyst Riccardo Fabiani.
Many people think it was too weak towards particularly Europe and Northern Europe. There's a perception in Italy that the government should have been harsher with Germany and with migrants as well.
Every day, hundreds, sometimes thousands more migrants arrive on Italy's southern shores. By far, the majority comes from Libya, where the political chaos allows people smugglers to profit from the endless human cargo. Europe supports the internationally recognized Libyan National Unity government, but that support has failed to stem the flow of migrants, says Fabiani.
Supporting the National Unity government, which is weak, divided, and has been very ineffective so far, is at odds with the idea of having a deal with a strong authority, a strong government in Libya, which is able to stem the flow of migrants towards Europe.
Some opposition parties, like the far-right Northern League, say Italy should instead support Libyan strongman General Khalifa Haftar.
Haftar, in their minds, is the General Sisi type of leader they can have a deal on the migrants crisis with. So definitely there are some parties that will try to exploit this issue.
The onset of winter is not deterring migrants. Doctors Without Borders field coordinator Ferry Shippers spoke to VOA via Skype from the rescue vessel Aquarius, which it operates with the charity SOS Mediterranean.
The seas are higher, it's more rain, it's cold, and I'm a bit amazed because the people keep on coming. We are doing a job that we should not be doing. I mean, the solution should come from a different party. And we are there because there obviously is not enough being done.
Doctors Without Borders says nearly 5,000 people have died this year on the crossing, and Italy and Europe have yet to find a solution. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhibi in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Sidrak Franklin, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America.